Hello there and welcome to the A to D talk show, where we talk about controversial issues and deliberate on them. We believe that the world is like a coin and it is best to see both sides of it. So come on, join us as we agree to disagree.
So good day everyone, how is your week going? This is A to D. Agree to Disagree talk show, and today we are going to be talking about culture and faith, the hope for greater things. And last week we talked about tribalism and religion, the Trojan horse, and the person who spoke about this thing very esoterically is Hamid, and he's the one talking to us today about culture and faith, the hope for greater things. And one of the very important things about Africa is that we all have things, like we said in the last episode, that we all have things that connect us together. We all have similarities more than our differences. But again, why do we have so much bigotry going on in the cultural aspect and the religious aspect? Now, the two primary faiths divide our home, Christianity and Islam. These two faiths have the same ancestral father, Abraham. Yet we see so much bigotry among those who practice this faith, the Christians and the Muslims. There is an apparent dichotomy between them. This dichotomy is in their approach and worship of God and their worldview of life after death. So we have the same are critical in sustaining our growth. Hamid, so when you hear about culture and faith, what's the first thing that comes to mind? You're muted.
Hello, Kelechi.
Yeah.
Hello, Kelechi, good evening.
Evening.
Good evening, everyone. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Hamid.
Hello, can you hear me? Yes. So, for me, when I hear the term culture to be very modernistic, it sounds like it is a form of control and segregation. Now, obviously, I'm going to expand further, but in a nutshell, today, when someone says, no, this is not my culture, or this is what my faith says, it's mostly about control. That is trying to control people that you believe belong to your group, and then segregation. The way you say, no, you are not one of me, you are different from me, so you are essentially, in some cases, my enemy. So when I hear faith and culture today, really what I hear is segregation, and identity mostly in some cases.
Yeah. So you made a point that I would need you to expand more on, because the truth is, like you explained, in the modernistic term of the world, or in the descriptive term of the world, culture, it almost seems like a dividing line between groups of people. But in the actual meaning, of culture, in the actual meaning of faith, in the actual classical description of culture, it has never been about segregation. It has never been about a dividing line. In the classical definition of culture, it has always been about the way of life. And the truth
Absolutely.
Is, and when we look at the way of life across different demographics, we see similarities. You don't have to be a core Yoruba person to understand the values of respect. Do you get? Yes, it may be different for you to. You may have a different way of showing respect, like in the Yoruba culture, is by lying down and saying your chest to the ground. It may be different. But in Europe and in the Western world, respect is also a value that is being appreciated by everyone. So when you begin to look at the and the classical definition of faith again, from a historical perspective, you would see that faith has been one of the fundamental stone or foundational stones in building societal and moral values. Because you don't have the idea of the idea of theft being a sin is not unique to Christianity. The idea of killing someone being a sin or being such a very nefarious act is not just unique to Christianity. Across all faith, even agnostics and atheists still share the same values that we all have in common in our faith-based relationship with God. So what I find very confusing today is people who radicalize the notion of their culture, who say, if you do not do this the way I do it, then there is a big problem. But today, we're not going to talk about the radicalization of culture and religion and faith, because we talked about that last week. What I want us to focus more about is in the ideology, in the idea of culture, in the crucible of faith, how can we seek hope for the greater good of the nation? And I'm saying this because, like I have said, that the foundational stone of a society is the family. And a family with good cultural values, with good societal values, with faith-based principles, is going to lead to a good society, is going to lead to a strong society with cultural values and with faith-based principles. So how can we channel up how can we narrow down the hope of a great country, of a great continent, to its culture and to its faith?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think if you take a step back and go back to the culture, to the contemporary, you know, meaning of culture and how it was applied and faith, you'll see that it was really about, you know, giving a community a sort of direction, guidance, and acknowledging the sort of practices that they have used to stay alive. It was never about, oh, this is who you are, this is who we are, that we have to fight. Even though, yes, it has been used in some instances, but if you see it in its classic form, in its absolutely pure form, you see that it's really more about just survival. You look at the sort of things that form a culture, be it the Igbo or the Yoruba or the Hausa, it's really about the environment and how they're interacting with their environment. A lot of the things that they do, the clothes that they wear, what they believe in, are things that surround them and things that help them to survive. For example, if you see the rain dance that you find maybe in the Igbo culture, it's mostly about the fact that the Igbo community is a heavy farming-based community. And if there isn't the right kind of rain where you can have in situation where this year is a very dry year, or you can have a very heavy year in terms of rain. So you find things like, you know, consulting the DPR to ask for rain. Even today, you can see that when they are having a wedding, they will have to go and meet, you know, someone that they will pay some sort of tithe so that they can pray for rain and make sure that pay that there's no rain.
Rain, yeah.
And see that there is a proper weather for the occasion. So you see that a lot of things that you find in the type in how people execute their beliefs is really more about survival. Now, it has transformed. And the transformation is not really inherent to any individual culture or faith, is in the need or quest of humans to survive. Like I said, I mentioned last week that it really is always, from my perspective, it's always about resources and about survival. And you see that people that, even Buddhists, that today are believed to be one of the most peace-loving, you know,
I don't think.
Hello.
Hamin, I lost you for a minute. You said you were talking about. I lost you when you started talking about Buddhists.
Yes. So, like, even Buddhists, for example, that are considered to be one of the most peace-loving people, like monks and all that, not engaging in lively things and things like that. Even them, they become radicalize and they start attacking people in their community because they feel like, no, you can't be here. This is my life. This is my land. I want you out. So you see that in a lot of cases where people from any kind of culture or faith engage in, you know, violence, it's almost always about survival. And it's this notion that we have that my survival is being hindered by the mere presence of someone else next to me.
But you see, in today's world, right, Hamid, in today's world, that narrative has always been pushed by political elites or people who want to explore the divide and conquer perspective. Because the truth is this, no culture in itself, I can't think of any culture right now that in its cultural value or any faith, in its culture, in its faith-based principle, has an agenda to eradicate another culture.
Yeah.
I can't think of a culture that says, okay, we exist because we want to make sure that this culture is completely obliterated. The person that tried it, he lost. Hitler, who tried to obliterate the Jews. But you see,
he didn't grow up thinking that wasn't the culture. That was really. And this is my point. It's always about they use it as in terms of survival.
Exactly.
I have to defend myself. If you attack, I have to defend myself. Exactly. And again, I was mentioned this is in a classical form, and it still exists in our hearts. Communities believe this. So people today use these foresights that exist, have always existed. They use it to divide and conquer us all the time. Whenever
it shows how credulous. We as human beings are. It shows how credulous we as human beings are. Because to think about it, Hamid, I want you to just think of any city that is doing well in the world today, any city that is doing well in any part of the world. You notice that city is either cosmopolitan. You know, those cities are usually cosmopolitan. These cities have diverse cultural values. You come to Nigeria today, Lagos is one of the only, I can say Lagos, maybe Lagos or maybe Kaduna, is one of the only cities that have all the cultures in it, that have all the tribes in it, that have all the religious people in it. If you look at New York, the same thing. If you look at Montreal, the same thing. Even the moment you're able to the moment a city, a society is able to add, to bring, to accept other cultural values and make them coexist among each other, you begin to see development. Because what I'm saying, yes, you made a very salient point about resources. And like I told you last week, I never looked at this thing from a resource perspective, right? But I keep saying this thing. No culture has an agenda to obliterate another culture. And when we see the politicians, the top bad actors trying to exploit the divide and conquer mechanism, it's because of their own personal gains. It's because of their own personal gains. That's the truth about it. In this world of political correctness, it's because of their own personal gains. Yes. For example, let me just narrow down my point with this analogy, because I know you have a whole lot to say, because you have traveled to 34 states in Nigeria. You have more exposure than I do when it comes to different cultures and different geographical locations. But let me just put this point so that I'm able to simplify what I'm saying. If you look at the Holocaust, and if you look at Hitler, the heinous acts he committed against the Jews, you will notice that the inspiration, one of the core inspirations of Adolf Hitler was Martin Luther. And Martin Luther was a Christian. I mean, he was a Christian. He was a Catholic priest. And Martin Luther was 400 years before Hitler came to be. Martin Luther had writings. Martin Luther basically did not like the Jews because he believed that they were infidels, that how would they believe that Jesus Christ is not the Son of God? So he wrote so many things about against the Jews. He even gave Christians at that time 8-point agendas on how to deal with the Jews. These 8-point agendas that Martin Luther gave to Christians was exactly what Hitler used. But to think about it so carefully, a man, a priest, who believes in Christ, and Christ is the way to the Father, and Jesus Christ, the person who he worships and serves, is a Jew. So how can a man how can a priest who's the founder and the captain of his religion is a Jew go against Jews? So it doesn't really make sense. But you see, it is because of the politics of divide and conquer. So I mean, I'm just trying to point that out, because every culture has brought their own good to the table and has helped the world in its growth and development. So I mean, you in your own take, what do you think? How do you think we should approach these things?
Yeah. So again, so really, just to tie everything you said together, right, is the bottom line is all the time, when it comes down to it, the leadership, and this is where leadership is always important, the kind of leaders you have, be it the top government, community leaders, spiritual leaders, they really determine the kind of outlook any community has.
I agree.
Because you can have a peace-loving community, but when they have a leader that they trust and believe in, they will always choose to follow whatever that leader gives to them as a truth. And that's what we see today over and over and over again. People that, you know, attach themselves to the righteousness of someone else other than themselves. That is, you don't expose yourself to the other realities of the world. You don't understand who you are. If you believe in God, you don't take the time to know who God is one-on-one. Then you know what it means to believe in God, so you can have someone that can guide you, rather than leaving all your, you know, spiritual direction to someone else. It's external, rather than it's being internal. And that's sort of the issues we are having.
Yeah.
And you look at any city or any place you see where there is sort of development, there exists like a multicultural people, and then there are a lot, you don't see a lot of conflict among those multicultures. You always see that they have a leadership where they do not use these force lines to rule their people, to gain their support. And this is what we see over and over again, even in democracy, even in politics, where people use populism mantra to push their agenda. This is exactly what Trump did to me. This is exactly what the Democrats do to whenever there's time for anti-republic slogans. They don't use the fact that, no, this is not right. No, this is what we should do. No. It's always, people are bad, these people are this, people are that, we need to do this to stop them. That's always a rhetoric. And yes, it's fine to win electorates, it's fine to get people behind you. But once you're done, once the people are behind you and that thing has been obliterated, you look for the next thing to hit. That is why when I look at the way Nigeria came to be, I always hate the fact that our independence was deeply rooted in a need to be sovereign, not in the need to develop ourselves.
Exactly.
And the difference is, at the point of independence, the Brits were our enemies.
True.
Everything was focused on them. No, if you were in the North, it was an issue of, no, the Brits are, these are Christians, these are the church archbishop, the queen, these are anti-Muslims, you can't be under them, we have to fight them, these are the enemies. Even the Quran says these are the enemies, and people galvanized behind their leaders. We need to fight, we need to revolt. When the revolt was over, they were gone, no more Christian leaders. Next thing they did was, who are the next Christian leaders we have? They looked east, they looked south. Mm-hmm. And it continued to happen. People continued to fight. So people that were living harmoniously for years before the coming of the Brits, suddenly, because the Brits were not there, could not live with one another. Because trade existed prior to the commission. Trade existed prior to the Brits ever stepping foot on African soil. True. People in the north and people in the south, everywhere in Africa was interconnected. Trade routes existed all over.
Yes.
So the issue that suddenly we can't live together, it's simply an issue of leadership. People have used sentiments to drive development rather than using the need for development itself to drive development. That you don't survive. That's what we are seeing today. If we don't innovate, if we don't develop, we're not going to survive. It's no longer about, oh, we need to be better. No. If you can't get an economy that's working, you're not going to get money in your economy. You can't create, you can't produce everything that you eat or consume. So it means you have to trade with other people. You can't trade without you yourself having what to trade with. If you don't produce, you can't trade properly. So really, we need to move on. I mean, any leaders that would take this route of saying that, listen, redevelopment has to come because we need it to survive. Not that development has to come because somebody else is developing faster than us. That should be bullshit the conversation. So
I agree with you.
The longer the sooner we start to understand, okay, whatever differences we have, whatever grievances we have, and this is really what I want to say and what I want to keep saying, because every day I go on Twitter or go on social media, like every post that you can think of, regardless of where you stand in the spectrum of political correctness, whether on the right or the left, whatever post you see that is like absolutely ridiculous for it to be true, you always find someone right there agreeing with it. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, we always find people that will agree, oh yeah, you're right, I can't believe, you just said what I was thinking. You just think, oh my God, people exist like this.
Yes.
There are actually people that believe in things like this. So I think we really need to, you know, move away from the criticism, from the abhorring so much hate, to actually constructive work.
Yeah,
we need to go back to our community to start talking with our elders in the communities, or the young people in the community, so that we can innovate to survive. I was seeing the other day, I was watching on Channel TV, they were doing a documentary about a community in Bielsa, living close to close to the river or something, that was flooding all the time. And they were calling on the government to come and help. The same thing with another community in Kogi. And I was just thinking, I know there's global warming and things like that, but these people have always existed close to water bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they suddenly reliant on someone else to come and help them when they've always existed and they've always interacted with these bodies smoothly and successfully? Why suddenly can they not do it on their own? Why can you not develop, you know, buildings that can exist on top of water, irrigation systems, things that you know that technology, not what you see on TV, just things that are local for you to do and help yourself in your community. So this is the kind of things that you see all over, where people are looking at someone else as being their savior or being the reason why they are not where they want to be. And we need to move away from that. We need to move away from the victim mentality to being proactive people.
Exactly.
That we look at our problems, we start coming together as a community and start working towards it.
Exactly. And this is the central point. You see, I'll say this and I'll keep saying this, right? There is no culture that I know of that they have a
specific... I think your network is back. It's bad. It's skipping.
Okay. Is it better now? It should be, please. Is it better?
Yeah, it's better now.
Okay, so like I said, there is no culture that exists that has a central agenda or has an agenda to obliterate another culture. And you see, the thing that a lot of, and I want us to move to the hope for greater things. The thing that a lot of people do not understand is the only thing keeping Nigeria and keeping Africa in, I would say, I mean, in its part, in this particular state, is our cultural values. I mentioned this thing in the first episode of Africa's History. We have strong cultural values in this country. We have strong cultural values in this continent. We have cultural values that cut across several demographics. You see, you could see in the West, they are fighting against these cultural values. They're fighting against family values. But here in Africa, we have cultural and we appreciate it. And that is why if you see once a Nigerian moves to the West, he begins to do better and even exceed the expectations of many people there, because we have good cultural values. We have good family values. We have faith-based values. But the problem we have is the radicalization. That is the problem we have. It is very easy for people to get radical. it is very easy for people to think that, okay, because of you are Muslim and I am a Christian, there is definitely nothing that joins us together. And that is totally a lie. That is completely false. That is completely false. On a societal and moral, on a societal and moral level, Muslims and Christians share quite a lot of things in common. But the problem is the political elites of this country and this continent have exploited it. And let me give you an example. When King Leopold II came to, he didn't really come to DR Congo, but when he sent Henry Stanley to DR Congo to explore DR Congo and the Holocaust that happened in DR Congo by King Leopold II, Henry Stanley was able to conquer DR Congo, one white man able to conquer the entire DRC, was due to this divide and conquer mentality. Okay, when they started fetching rubber, what did Henry Stanley do? He had to set up an army. The army that he set up was called the First Republic. This army was set up to always amputate the hands of people who didn't meet up to their rubber quota for each day. So the point is, everybody in the society, in the community, had a particular amount or liter of rubber that he or she is supposed to fetch in a day. If you do not fetch up to that amount of rubber, your hands will get amputated, or you should be killed. And the only way that King Leopold could verify that you are killed is if they amputate your hands. So they formed a military called First Republic that would enforce this particular style. And the people who made up this First Republic were Congolese people. So Congolese people were amputating the hands of other Congolese people. This is the same way slavery was being perpetuated in Africa. The white man didn't come to Africa and didn't come to Africa on a hostile takeover or via kidnapping people. No. It was due to this same cultural bigotry. People who were being held as prisoners of war were those who have been sold to the white man. It's the same cultural bigotry. It is saying you are not from my culture, so therefore you're subhuman. It's this same bigotry that has been in this African system for so long that the moment we see somebody that has the slightest difference from us, we think he's subhuman and we're able to sell him off for anything. So again, we have everything in common in this in Africa. Everything. Igbo people appreciate respect. The South Africans appreciate respect. The Kenyans appreciate respect. We all have family values. We all have moral values. So why is it that there is this aggrandization of our dichotomy? But again, like we have said and we have agreed, it is due to the leadership the bad leadership consequences that exist in Africa. So Hamid, I wanted this to be a 30-minute session. Do you have any other thing you want to say that will drive your point home so we can wrap it up? And if you have questions, please always ask. If you have questions or contributions, you're free to make them.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm given the group we're having right now live, I just want to, I know the question now is, as an northerner that is a Muslim, how can you talk about, you know, cooperation? How can you talk about nationalism, living with their neighbor when it is apparent that everywhere you go, you see Muslims fighting or killing someone, or whenever there's something that is contrary to what we believe in, it seems that we are the choice or the route Muslims always seek is to kill or to go to war or to, you know, use conflict or use violence as a resort.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say this very, very clearly. Now, while I don't consider myself to be a scholar, I am very, very well read. Let me take out a few berries. I'm well read. Okay, I've read a lot in terms of Islamic theology. I'm not an expert, but I know enough. And I know the history of Islam. I know the Quran, I know a lot of hadith in terms of interaction and society, and I can tell you for free. Every instance that you've heard where a Muslim say that, oh, you're supposed to kill this or kill that, it's always in a defensive context. Today, when Muslims talk about Sharia, I always wonder, what do you think Sharia is going to do? Because if Sharia is established, it doesn't say that you kill everybody in that land and take over their property. It's not going to work like that. You're going to live with them, whatever happens, even if you have a Khalifa, even if the Prophet we are living today, was he's not going to order you to go and kill everybody and take over their property. It's never part of the Sharia. So when Muslims talk about, oh, when we need to establish this or establish that, the way the world is structured today, there will not be any context where a community that is living peacefully, where you just stand up and suffer from everybody. It can never exist. It will never exist. Now, the point I'm trying to make is, for any Muslim listening to this that believes your religion teaches you to fight or cause commotion or kill someone that doesn't look like you or believe in what you believe in, that's what the religion teaches. And I've read enough of the Bible to know that the Christianity does not teach any of that. Yeah. I think Christians are the people that don't have any of that problem in terms of their ideologies. Maybe back in the 10th century, maybe there was that, it doesn't exist anymore. A lot of Christians do not have things that have to do with warfare or things like that. Mostly it's cultural defensive mechanisms that they have to use. So Muslims are really the ones I'm talking about today. There is nothing about the religion that says you need to fight anybody. There's nothing about the religion that says you cannot live with people. You can only live with people that are Muslims. Nothing like that. If you need to fix anything, fix your relationship with God. Yes, there are things that we need to, we need to defend in terms of Islamic values and things like that. But we do that through diplomatic means. This is where it has always existed. It's part of the Islamic values and laws and Sharia. There are diplomatic means of doing things, and they're always the first resort. And today's world, there's nothing that you cannot win with diplomacy. It's always about having the right support and the right, the right partners to do it. So there's no reason for you to fight anybody. There's no reason for you to kill anybody. Anything that you need to do, work with your community, both Muslims and non-Muslims. And this is the only way we can live out the principles of Islam. This is the only way you can manifest the true teachings of God and the Prophet in your lives. It's by living together. It's not by fighting someone or fighting the other person. It's not by blaming leaders or thinking, oh, how many people have you seen as a Muslim? How many Muslims have you seen that have been completely, nonchalant about our development? It's not about whether you're a Muslim or you're not a Muslim. That's when development comes. No. Mm-hmm. Well, who is capable? Yeah. Who is patriotic enough to want to develop where they want to develop their country? It's never about who they are in terms of their background. It's always about their outlook in life. So really, if you want to move forward, we need to move away from this belief that the only way we can develop is if someone from our community that looks like me, that believes in what I believe, that's the only person that can do right by me. That is false. A righteous person, be it an atheist, be it someone that is gay, or someone that thinks their pronoun is we, as long as he's a righteous person that is capable, will do right by you. And I'm saying this, like, a lot of groups will disagree with this, the kind of classification I've just given. And that's why I use that classification, not because of any sort of, stereotype. It's just because, regardless of how you think someone is different from you, as long as they are capable and they are righteous, whatever they believe in, they can do right by you in terms of what your rights are when it comes to them. Development, social development, infrastructure development. So we should move away from this belief that, oh, communities are there, so communities are the only members that can usher in change. No. Let's look for leaders that are capable. Let us together call out our leaders, make sure that they are accountable to us, not accountable to other tribes. And well, for us, no problem, you are from us, do whatever you want to do, we have your back. No. Do not let the voices of disunity, the voices of, of mayhem to be the ones leading your charge. Don't listen to voices that anybody that tells you go and kill somebody. I don't care who, how high that person is. As long as that person tells you to go and commit violence, he is on his own. He is not telling you for any righteous source, yeah, be it a Muslim or whoever it is. I am telling you this without any caveats. The one that just tells you, wakes up today and tells you to go and kill somebody without any sort of justification. Even if the person kills who your mother, they are caught. Mm-hmm. So do not let anybody use you for any sort of violence or any sort of mischief. Let's work together. Let's sit together. I am someone whose father is Yoruba, whose mother is from Edo State, who the person that raised me is Fulani. I grew up in Kaduna. So really, my blood runs thick with Nigeria. I have different kind of Nigerians in my background. So I can't even be, you know, antagonistic to any group because I'll be ultimately antagonistic to my people. I have Christian, family members. I have Muslim family members. I have my grandfather used to worship. He's a traditionalist. You have a shrine. I can still see my grandfather's shrine when I go to Edo today. So really, I am the full package of Nigeria. And I'm telling you this, I have seen all sides of it. I have seen different people. I have interacted with different people. And I know that if you really want to come together, it is possible. People are doing it. And we can do it in a larger scale. And it starts with us. Let's move away from the hate rhetoric. Let's move away from the, you know, blaming game and move to embracing one another and being accountable to one another and holding each other accountable in a peaceful and loving way.
So that's
my long final statement.
Yeah, thank you very much, Hamid. Yeah. And I'm happy you spoke about it because of what is currently going on in Nigeria today. And to be honest with you, it is a very big shame. It is a very, very big shame as how easily people can get radicalized. But the truth is, I have been graced with very, very good Northern friends. I've been graced with very, very good Muslims. I have been graced with very good people from different parts of the world and different parts of Nigeria. And like I said last week, one of the most nefarious acts that has been committed against me and against my identity came from an Igbo person. So if I'm going to completely obliterate a race or a group of people because of one thing one person did, then I would first look at myself, I would first take myself out. So thank you very much, Hamid. Thank you all for being here, those listening on the podcast and those live. And I appreciate all of you. We have next week, we are going to be talking about a very important topic, and that is African youth, the hope, or a ticking time bomb. So this is just going to speak mainly on the youthful people of Africa and the future that they have in stock of the continent itself. So thank you all very much for joining. And we'll upload the podcast maybe next week or next week, Wednesday or Thursday. Those listening on the podcast, I appreciate you all. And as always, thanks for listening. And Hamid, I appreciate you. Thank you very much for being here.